You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner from Collected Works 60 and 61, entitled Turning Points in Spiritual History, translated by Walter F. Knox. This is Lecture 3, entitled Buddha. And it was given on March 2nd, 1911. In these days, there is much discussion concerning the Buddha and the Buddhist creed. This fact is the more interesting to all who follow the course of human evolution, because a knowledge of the true character of the Buddhist religion, or perhaps more correctly, the longing felt by many for its comprehension, has only recently entered into the spiritual life of the Western nations. Let us consider for a moment that most prominent personality, Johann Wolfgang von Goethe, who exerted such a powerful influence on Western culture at the turn of the 18th and 19th centuries, which influence continued so potently right on into our own period. When we examine his life, his works, and his intellectuality, we find no trace of the Buddhist doctrine. A little later, however, we note in the concepts of that genius, Arthur Schopenhauer, who was in a certain sense a disciple of Goethe, a clear and definite touch of Buddhistic thought, and since that period in which Schopenhauer lived, the interest taken in Eastern spiritual conceptions has steadily increased. Hence, it is that there is now a widespread and inherent desire to analyze and discuss all those matters connected with the name of the great Buddha that have found their way into the course of human evolution. It is a remarkable fact that most people still persist in associating Buddhism primarily with the idea of recurrent earth lives, to which concept we have often referred in these lectures. Such an assumption is, however, found to be unwarranted when we regard the essential character of Buddhist belief. We might say that with the majority of those people who interest themselves in this subject, the notion of repeated earth lives, or as we term it, reincarnation, forms a well-established and essential part of their preconceived ideas regarding Buddhism. But on the other hand, it must be said, even though it sounds grotesque, that to those who probe more deeply into these matters, the association of Buddhism with the idea of reincarnation appears almost equivalent to saying that the most complete knowledge of ancient works of art is to be sought among those peoples who have destroyed them at the commencement of universal development and progress in the Middle Ages. This certainly sounds grotesque, but it is nevertheless true, as we at once realize when we consider that the aim of Buddhism is directed toward the disparagement of our apparently inevitably recurring earth lives, and the reduction of their number as far as may be within our power. So we must regard as the essential moving principle underlying the whole trend of Buddhist spiritual thought that principle which operates in the direction of freedom, that is, redemption from repeated rebirth, or liberation from reincarnation, which it accepts as an established and unquestionable fact. In this concept is expressed the true and vital essence of Buddhism. Even from a superficial glance at the history of Western spiritual life, we learn that the idea of repeated earthly existence is quite independent of an understanding of Buddhism, and vice versa. For during the course of our Western spiritual development, we find ourselves confronted with a conception of reincarnation, presented in a manner both lofty and sublime, by a personality who most certainly remained untouched by Buddhist views and trend of thought. This personality was Gotthold Lessing, who in his treatise The Education of Humankind, which is regarded as the most mature and mellow of his works, closes with the confession that he himself was a believer in the doctrine of reincarnation. With regard to this belief, he gives expression to those deeply significant words, quote, "Is not all eternity mine?" Close quote. Lessing was of the opinion that the repetition of our earthly lives was proof that benefit would accrue from mundane endeavor, and that existence in this world is not in vain. For while we toil, we look forward to ever-widening and fuller recurring corporeal states, in which we may bring to maturity the fruits of our bygone earthly lives. The conception that Lessing really formed was of the prospect and anticipation of a rich and bountiful harvest to be garnered in the fullness of time, coupled with the knowledge that throughout human existence there is ever an inner voice that in actual expectation of recurrent earth lives calls to us, saying, quote, "Thou shalt persist in thy labors." Close quote. From what has been said, it is now apparent that it is in the very essence of Buddhism that human beings must strive to obtain such knowledge and wisdom as may serve to free them from those future reincarnations, the prevision of which lies in the spirit. Only when, during one of our earth lives, we have at last freed ourselves from the need of experiencing those that would otherwise follow, can we enter peacefully upon that condition which we may term eternity. I have persistently endeavored to make it clear that the idea of reincarnation, both with regard to spiritual science and theosophy, was not derived from any one of the ancient traditions, not even from Buddhism. It has, in fact, thrust itself upon us during our time as a result of independent observation and reflection concerning life in connection with spiritual investigation. To associate Buddhism so directly with the idea of reincarnation indicates a superficial attitude. If we would indeed look into the true character and nature of Buddhism, then we must turn our spiritual eyes in quite another direction. I must now, once again, draw your attention to that law in human evolution which we met with when we were considering the personality of the great Zarathustra. In accordance with this law, as was then stated, during the gradual passing of time, the whole condition and character of the human soul changed, while it went through varying transitional states. Those events regarding which we obtain information from external historical documents represent, as far as the human being is concerned, only a comparatively late phase in the evolution of humanity. If, however, we look back with the aid of spiritual science to prehistoric times, we gain much more knowledge. We then find that a certain condition of soul was common to the primitive human being, whereby the normal state of human consciousness was quite other than that of our day. The preeminently intellectual order of consciousness that leads to the manner in which, during the course of our normal human life, we now regard all things around us, combining them by means of our mental powers acting through the brain, so that they shall be connected with and become a part of our wisdom and our science, was first developed from another form of conscious state. I have emphasized this point before, but I must lay particular stress upon it once again. We have in the chaotic disorder of our dream life a last remnant, a species of atavistic heritage, of an old clairvoyance, which was at one time, and to a certain extent, an ordinary condition of the human soul, and in which humankind assumed a state between that of sleeping and that of being awake. Humans could then look upon those things hidden behind the perceptual world. In these days in which our consciousness mainly alternates between the sleeping and the waking conditions, it is only in the latter that we seek to apprehend a state of intellectuality in the soul. In olden times, however, clairvoyant visions were not so meaningless as are the dream forms of our period, for they could be quite definitely ascribed to specific super-perceptual creations and events. Humankind had, in connection with these ancient fluctuating visions, a species of conscious state out of which our present intellectuality gradually evolved. Thus we look back to a certain form of primeval clairvoyance that was followed by the long drawn-out evolution of our consciousness as recognized today. Because of this bygone, dreamlike clairvoyance, prehistoric human beings could gaze far into the superperceptual worlds, and through this connection with the supersensible, they gained not knowledge alone, but also a feeling of profound inner satisfaction and bliss from the full realization of the soul's union with the spirit world. Just as present-day human beings are now convinced through sense perceptions and intellectuality that the blood is composed of substances that exist outside in the physical universe, so were prehistoric human beings confident that their soul and spiritual nature emanated from that same hidden spirit world, which they could discern by virtue of clairvoyant consciousness. It has already been pointed out that there are phenomena connected with the history of humankind, and which are also apparent in certain external facts and happenings, that can be fully understood only when we presuppose some such primordial condition of human earthly existence. It has further been stated that modern science is coming more and more to the conclusion that it is erroneous to assume, as has been done by the materialistic anthropology of the 19th century, that in primeval times the prevailing state common to human beings was similar to that found among the most primitive peoples of today. It is, in fact, becoming more and more clear that the prehistoric races had extremely exalted theoretical conceptions regarding the spirit world, and that these concepts were given to them in the form of visions. All those curious ideas that come to us through myths and legends can be rightly understood only when they are first connected with and referred back to the ancient wisdom that came to humankind in a way wholly different from that by which our present intellectual science has been attained. In these modern times, there is not much sympathy expressed with the view that the position in which we find the primitive peoples of our day is not typical of the universal primordial condition of humankind, but is in reality an example of decadence from a primarily highly clairvoyant spiritual state common to all peoples. But facts will yet force a general acceptance of some such hypothesis as that put forward by spiritual science as a result of its investigations. Here, as in many other cases, it can be shown that fundamentally there is complete accord between spiritual and external science. Further, a time will come when the conclusions that spiritual science has formed regarding the probable future of human evolution, viewed from the scientific standpoint, will be entirely confirmed. We must look back not merely to a form of primeval wisdom, but indeed to a specific order of primordial feeling and apprehension, which we characterize as a clairvoyant bond once existing between human beings and the divine regions of spirit. We can easily understand that during the transition from the old or clairvoyant state of the human soul to our modern direct, unprejudiced, and intellectual method of regarding the external perceptual world, there should arise two different currents of thought. As time went on, the first of these currents manifested more especially among those people who had clung to memories of the past and to their fading psychic power, in such manner that they would say, quote, "In bygone days humankind was truly in contact with the spirit realms through the clairvoyant faculty. But since then human beings have descended into the material world of sense perception." Close quote. This feeling spread throughout the whole soul's outlook, until those ancient peoples would cry out, quote, "We are indeed now come into a world of manifestations where all is illusion, all is Maya." Close quote. Only at such time as human beings might commune with the spirit spheres could they truly comprehend and be united with their very being. Thus it was that there came to those nations that still preserved a dim remembrance of the ancient primal clairvoyant state a certain feeling of sadness at the thought of what they had lost, and an indifference to all material things that that human beings might apprehend and understand through the medium of the intellect, and with which they are ever in direct and conscious contact. On the other hand, the second of the two thought currents to which I have referred may be expressed in the following manner, quote, "We will observe and be active in this new world that has been given to us." Close quote. Thought of this nature is especially noticeable throughout the Zarathustrian doctrine. Those who experienced this call to action did not look back with sorrow and longing to the loss of the old clairvoyant power, but felt more and more that they must keep in close and constant touch with those forces by the aid of which they might penetrate into the secrets and nature of all material things, knowing full well that knowledge and guidance, born of the Spirit, would flow in upon them if they would but give themselves up to earnest and profound meditation and piety. Such people felt impelled to link themselves closely with the world. There was no dreaming of the past, but instead an urge to gaze resolutely into the future, and to battle with what might come. They express themselves after this fashion, quote, "Interwoven throughout this world, which is now our portion, is the same divine essence that was spread about us and permeated our very beings in bygone ages. This spiritual component we must now seek amid our material surroundings. It is our task to unite ourselves with all that is good and of the Spirit, and by so doing to further the progress and evolution of creation." Close quote. These words indicate the essential nature of the current of thought that was occupied with external physical perception, and went forth from those Asiatic countries where the Zarathustrian doctrine prevailed, which lay northward of the region where humankind looked back in meditation, pondering over that great spiritual gift that had passed away and was indeed lost. Thus it came about that upon the soil of India there arose a spiritual life that is entirely comprehensible when we regard it in the light of all this retrospection concerning a former union with the spirit world. If we consider the results in India of the teachings of the Sankhya and Yoga philosophies and the Yoga training, we find that these may be embodied in the following statement, quote, "Indians have ever striven to re-establish their connection with those spirit worlds from whence they came, and it has been their constant endeavor to eliminate from their earthly life all that was spread around them in external creation, and, by thus freeing themselves from material things, to regain their union with that spiritual region from whence humanity has emanated. The principle underlying yoga philosophy is reunion with the divine realms and abstraction from all that appertains to the perceptual world." Close quote. Only when we assume this fundamental mood of Indian spiritual life can we realize the significance of that mighty impulse brought about by the advent of the Buddha, which blazed up before our spiritual sight as an afterglow across the evening sky of Indian soul life just a few centuries before the Christ impulse began to dominate Western thought. It is only in the light of the Buddha mood, when regarded as characterized here, that the outstanding figure of the Buddha can be truly comprehended. In view of that basic assumption to which we have referred, we can readily conceive that in India there could exist an order of thought and conviction such as caused humankind to regard the world as having fallen from a spiritual state into one of sense illusion, or the, quote, "great deception," close quote, that is indeed Maya. It is also understandable that Indians, because of their observations concerning this external world, with which humanity is so closely connected, pictured to themselves that this decline came about suddenly and unexpectedly from time to time during the passing of the ages. So that Indian philosophy does not regard the fall of humanity as uniform and continuous, but rather as having taken place periodically from epoch to epoch. From this point of view, we can now understand those contemplative moods underlying a form of culture that we must regard as being in the departing radiance of its existence. For so must we characterize the Buddhist conception, if we would consider it as having a place in a philosophy such as we have outlined. Indian thought ever harked back to that dim past when humans were truly united with the spirit world. For there came a time when Indians fell away from their exalted spiritual standard. This decline persisted until a certain level was reached, when they rose again, only to sink once more. They continued to alternate in this fashion throughout the ages, every descent taking them still further along the downward path, while each upward step was, as it were, a mitigation granted by some higher power, in order that humans might not be compelled to work and live all too suddenly in the condition that they had already entered upon during their fall. According to ancient Indian philosophy, as each period of decline ended, there arose a certain outstanding figure whose personality was known as a Buddha. The last was incarnated as the son of King Suddhodana and called Gautama Buddha. Since those olden times, when humanity was still directly united with the spirit world, there have arisen a number of such Buddhas, five having appeared subsequent to the last fall. The advent of the Buddhas was a sign that humankind will not sink into illusion, into Maya, but that again and again there will come into human beings' lives something of the ancient primal wisdom to succor and aid humanity. Because of human beings' constant downward trend, however, their primordial knowledge fades from time to time. In order that it shall be renewed, there arises periodically a new Buddha. The last was Gautama Buddha. Before such great teachers could advance through repeated earth lives to the dignity of Buddhahood, if we may so express it, they must have already been exalted and attained the lofty standing of a bodhisattva. Footnote, bodhisattva Sanskrit, a bodhisat, one whose essence is enlightenment, that is, one destined to become a Buddha elect. End of footnote. According to the Indian philosophical outlook, up to his 29th year, Gautama Buddha was not regarded as a Buddha, but as a bodhisattva. It was therefore as a bodhisattva that he was born into the royal house of Suddhodana. Because his life was ever devoted to toil and to striving, he was at last blessed with that inner illumination symbolically portrayed in the words, quote, sitting under the Bodhi tree, close quote, and the glorious enlightenment that flowed in upon him found expression in the sermon at Benares. Thus did Gautama Buddha rise to the full dignity of Buddhahood in his 29th year. From that time on he was empowered to revive once again a last remnant of bygone primeval wisdom, which in the light of Indian conceptions would be destined to fall into decadence during the centuries to come. But according to these same concepts, when human beings have sunk so low that the wisdom and the knowledge which this last Buddha brought shall have waned, then will yet another bodhisattva rise to Buddhahood, the Buddha of the future, the Maitreya Buddha, whose coming the Indians surely await, for it is foretold in their philosophy. Let us now consider what took place at that time, when the last bodhisattva rose to Buddhahood, when, as we might say, his soul became filled with primordial wisdom. In this way we can best realize and understand the true significance of that great change, wrought by struggle and toil through repeated earth lives. There is a legend that tells us that, until his 29th year, he had seen nothing of the world outside the royal palace of Suddhodana, and that he was protected from the misery and suffering that are factors of existence ever antagonistic to human prosperity in life's progress. It was under these conditions that the bodhisattva grew up. At the same time, however, he was possessed of the bodhisattva consciousness, a consciousness imbued with inner wisdom garnered from previous incarnations. Hence, as he developed during his life's unfolding, He looked only upon those things that would bring forth true and goodly fruits. Since this legend is so well known, it is necessary to refer only to the main points. It states that when the Buddha at length went outside the royal palace, he had an experience such as could not have occurred before. Namely, he beheld a corpse. And he realized on seeing this body that life is dissolved by death, and that the death element breaks in upon life's procreative and fruitful progress. He next came upon an ailing and feeble man, and knew that disease enters upon life. Again he saw an aged person tottering and weary, and he understood that old age creeps in upon the freshness of youth. Let us now place ourselves in the position of those who look upon experiences of this nature solely from the Buddhistic point of view, for instance, in the position of this bodhisattva, Gautama. Gautama was possessed of a higher wisdom that lived within him, but was as yet not fully developed. He had, up to this period, seen only the fortunate and wealthy side of life. Now, for the first time, he beheld the elements of decay and dissolution. If we consider the way in which he must have regarded these happenings, as viewed from the standpoint of assumptions forced upon him by his inner being, we can readily understand how it was that this great spiritual Buddha came to express himself in words somewhat as follows, quote, "When we attain to knowledge and to wisdom, it comes about that by virtue of such wisdom we are led onward toward development and progress. And because of this enlightenment, there enters into the soul the thought of an ever continuous and beneficial growth and advancement. When we look upon the world about us, however, we see there the elements of destruction, as expressed in sickness, old age, and death. Truly, it cannot be wisdom that would thus mingle these destructive factors with life, but something quite apart and distinctive in character." Close quote. At first, the great Gautama did not fully grasp all that his bodhisattva consciousness implied. And we can well understand how it was that he became imbued with those thoughts that caused him to exclaim, quote, "Humans may indeed be possessed of much wisdom, and through their knowledge there may come to them the idea of plenteous benefits. In life, however, we behold around us not only the factors of sickness and death, but indeed many other baneful elements that bring corruption and decay into our very existence." Close quote. From the perspective of Buddhism, Indian philosophy presupposes that he who was a bodhisattva and is exalted to Buddhahood regards all such life experiences with the bodhisattva consciousness. This supposition must be clearly understood. Gautama realized that in the great wisdom underlying development in all being, there is an element destructive to existence. The legend states that when this truth first dawned upon him, his great soul was so affected that he cried out, quote, "Life is full of misery." Close quote. The bodhisattva thus saw around him a condition he could not as yet fully comprehend. He had passed through life after life, always applying the experiences gained through his previous incarnations to his soul's benefit. In the course of these repeated lives, his wisdom became greater and greater, till at last he could look down upon all earthly existence from a more exalted vantage point. But when he came forth from the king's palace and saw before him for the first time the realities of life, its true nature and significance did not at once penetrate his understanding. The knowledge that we gain from the repeated experiences of our earth lives, and which we store within us as wisdom, can never solve the ultimate secrets of our being, for the true origin of these mysteries must lie without, remote from the life that is ours as we pass from reincarnation to reincarnation. Such thoughts matured in the great soul of Gautama, and led him directly to that sublime enlightenment known as, quote, "the illumination under the Bodhi tree," close quote. Footnote, Bodhi tree, fig tree, ficus religiosa, known also as the Bo tree. End of footnote. There, while seated beneath the tree, it became clear to the Buddha that this world in which we have our being is Maya, or illusion. That here life follows upon life, and that we have come upon this earth from a spiritual realm. While we are here, we may indeed be exalted and even rise to noble heights in the divine sense, and we may pass through many reincarnations, becoming ever more and more possessed of wisdom. Because of that which is material and comes to us through contact with this earthly life, however, we can never solve the great ever-present mystery of existence that finds expression in old age, disease, and death. It was at this time of enlightenment that the thought came to Gautama that the teachings born of suffering held for him a greater significance than all the wisdom of a bodhisattva. The Buddha expressed the fundamental concept underlying his great illumination as follows, quote, "That which spreads itself abroad throughout this world of Maya is not wisdom. Indeed, so little of this quality is manifested in life that we can never hope to gain from external experiences a true understanding of affliction, or acquire the knowledge that will show us the way by which we may be freed from suffering. For interwoven throughout all outer existence is a factor of quite another character, which differs from all wisdom and all knowledge." Close quote. It is therefore obvious that what the Buddha sought was an element through the agency of which the destructive forces of old age, sickness, and death become commingled with earthly life, and in which wisdom has no part. He held that freedom from these baneful factors can never come through mundane knowledge and learning, for the path leading to deliverance does not lie in that direction, and can be found only when the human being withdraws entirely from the external world, where life follows upon life, and reincarnation upon reincarnation. Thus it was the Buddha realized from the moment of his illumination that in the teachings and experience born of affliction lay that basic element necessary to humanity for its future progress. He conceived a factor, wherein was no wisdom, that he termed, quote, "the thirst for existence," close quote, to be the true source of all the misery and sorrow that so trouble the world. Upon the one side there is wisdom, and upon the other a thirst for existence, where wisdom has no part. It was this thought that caused Gautama to exclaim, quote, "Only liberation from recurrent earth life can lead humanity to the realization of perfect freedom, for earthly wisdom, even that of the highest learning, cannot save us from grief and anguish." Close quote. He thereby gave himself up to meditation, and sought some means whereby humankind might be led away from all the restlessness in the world of reincarnations, and guided into the transcendent state that Gautama Buddha designated Nirvana. What then is the nature of this state, this world of Nirvana, that human beings will enter when they have so advanced in earthly life that the thirst for existence has passed, and they no more desire to be reborn? We must understand this concept rightly, for then shall we avoid those grotesque and fantastic ideas so frequently spread abroad. Nirvana is a condition that can be characterized only in the Buddhist sense. According to this conception, it is a world of redemption and bliss that can never be expressed in terms of things that may be apprehended in the material state in which we have our being. There is nothing in this physical world, or in the wide expanse of the cosmos, that can awaken in humankind a realization of the sublime truth underlying such redemption. Hence we should forbear from all pronouncements and assertions regarding that glorious region where humanity must seek salvation. All earth-born predications and profitless statements, such as human beings are ever prone to make, must be stilled, for in them is nothing pertaining to the spheres of eternal bliss. There is indeed no possibility of picturing that realm where all may enter who have overcome the need for reincarnation, since it is not of a substance with those things of which we may have awareness in this earthly life. When, therefore, we would speak of this condition we must use a negative, indefinite term. Such a term is nirvana. Those who have conquered all mundane desires shall yet know the nature and the aspect of that other world, which we can but indicate with one vague and neutral word, nirvana. It is a region that, according to the Buddhist, no language can portray. It is not nihilism. It is indeed so far removed from such a concept that we can find no words wherewith to describe this state of being so perfect, so complete, perfect, and all abounding in ecstasy and bliss. We are now in a position to grasp and apprehend the very essence of Buddhism, its sentiments, and its convictions. From the time of the sermon at Benares, when the Buddha first gave expression to the doctrine of suffering, Buddhism became permeated with thought and understanding concerning the inner nature of life's misery and distress, and of that yearning, that thirst for existence that leads only to sorrow and affliction. There is, according to this doctrine, only one way in which humanity may truly progress, and that is through gaining freedom and redemption from further reincarnations. Humankind must find the path of knowledge that extends outward and beyond all earthly wisdom, the path that is the way and the means whereby slowly and step by step human beings may become so fitted and conditioned that they can at last enter upon the ideal state of nirvana. In other words, they must learn to utilize the experiences of their rebirths in such a way that finally recurrent earth life is no longer essential to development, and they are freed from it forever. If we now turn from this brief summary of the conceptions that underlie Buddhism to the root and essence of this religion, it at once strikes us as peculiar when viewed in the light of our ideas concerning humanity regarded as a whole. For Buddhism, in point of fact, isolates the individual. Questions are raised relative to human destiny, the purport and aim of existence, the place and relation of human beings to the world, all from the standpoint of detached and separate personality. How indeed could any other trend of thought underlie a philosophy built upon a fundamental disposition of mind such as we have outlined? A philosophy evolved from a basic mood that conceives human beings as being descended from spiritual heights and now finding themselves in a world of illusion from which material existence, the wisdom of a Buddha, may from time to time free him. But this very wisdom, as was seen in the case of the last Buddha, causes him to seek redemption from his earthly life. How could the goal of human existence, born as it was of convictions such as these, be characterized other than by representing humans as isolated in relation to the whole of their environment? According to this philosophy, the fundamental aspect of being is such as to represent decline, while development and evolution in earthly life implies degeneration. The manner in which the Buddha sought enlightenment is both remarkable and significant. But unless we consider also the peculiar characteristics and circumstances connected with the illumination, in quotes, neither the Buddha himself nor Buddhism can be properly understood. When Gautama craved enlightenment, he went forth into solitude, to a place where he could find entire and absolute isolation. All that he had acquired from life to life had to be overcome in the utter detachment of his being, so that there could break in upon his soul that clear light whereby he might comprehend and solve the mystery of the world's wretchedness. There, in that place, as one in complete aloofness and dependent upon himself alone, the Buddha awaited the moment of illumination, that moment when there should come to him an understanding which would enable him to realize that the true cause of all human suffering lay in the intense longing manifested by individuals to be born again into this material world. Moreover, he understood that this yearning for reincarnation, this thirst for existence, is the fundamental source of all the misery and distress everywhere around us, and of those pernicious factors that bring ruin and destruction into our very being. We cannot rightly comprehend the unusual and singular nature of the Buddha illumination and of the Buddhistic doctrine unless we compare them with the knowledge and experience we have gained through Christianity. 600 years after the advent of the great Buddha, there arose in Christendom a wholly different conception, in which we also find human beings positioned relative to the world, and all that is around them expressed in definite terms. Regarding Buddhism and speaking in an abstract and general manner, we can say, quote, "The philosophic outlook concerning the cosmos as set forth in Buddhistic teachings is not treated historically, and this unhistoric method is thoroughly typical of all Eastern countries. These countries have seen one Buddha epoch follow upon another, only to gradually die out and eventually come to an end." Such descriptions as are concerned merely with the human being's descent from higher to lower states do not of themselves constitute what we term history, for the factors of true history would include the upward endeavor of humanity to reach some appointed goal, and the nature and possibilities of the human being's association and union with the world as a whole, both in the past and in the future. We would then have veritable history. But Buddhists stand isolated and alone, concerned only with the basic principles of their individual being, and always seeking to gain, through the conduct of their personal life, those powers that may lead to freedom from the thirst for existence, so that having attained to this freedom, they may at last win redemption from rebirth. There's a beginning of a quote, and I cannot find the end of that quote, so I'm not sure if it's been printed. Sorry about that. End of reader's aside. In Christendom, 600 years after the Buddha period, the attitude of the individual human being toward the evolution of humanity in general was of quite another kind. Putting aside all prejudice, which is so common a failing throughout the world, we can characterize one particular Christian trend of thought as follows. From the part of the Christian concept founded upon the stories in the Old Testament, it is realized that the ancients were related to the spiritual realms in a manner wholly different from that which was subsequently the case, as is seen in the grand and lofty imagery depicted in Genesis. A curious fact comes to light, namely that in Christendom we find the human being's relation to the world to be of a character entirely unlike that which one obtains in Buddhism. The following may be considered as the Christian's point of view, quote, "Within my being is understanding begotten of the condition of soul that is now mine. Because of the manner in which I observe and comprehend this outer perceptual world, there is born in me wisdom, intelligence, and an aptitude for the practical conduct of life. But I can look back into the distant past, when the human soul was differently conditioned. At that time there came about a circumstance, the fall of the human being, that cannot be regarded simply from the Buddhistic standpoint." Close quote. This event, which we so often find portrayed in figurative form, based upon misconception, the Buddhist believes to be a natural result of the human being's descent from divine spiritual heights into a world of Maya. This great fall must, however, be looked upon quite differently, for truly characterized it is the fall of human beings, as caused wholly through their own transgression, and not due, as the Buddhist thinks, merely to their coming down from a higher spiritual state and entering a world of deception, Although human beings may have their own opinion concerning this matter, there is one thing we must admit, and that will suffice for the present. In connection with the thought of the fall, there is an inner sentiment that causes the human being to exclaim, quote, "As I am now, there work within me certain impulses and forces that have surely not developed in my being alone, for similar factors were active in a not so very distant past, when they played a part in happenings of such a nature that the human race, to which I belong, not only lapsed from its former higher spiritual standard, but indeed fell so far that humankind has come into a different relation with the world than the one that would have been if the original conditions had but endured. Close quote. When human beings fell away from their previous high spiritual state, they sank to a definitely lower level, and this change was brought about by what may be termed their own conscious sin. We are therefore not concerned merely with the fact of descent, as is the case when the fall is viewed from the Buddhist perspective, for we must take into consideration varying moods during this period of decadence. If human beings' first nature had continued unchanged, this decline would not have the character it has now assumed, where the soul state is such that they are always prone to fall into temptation. Readers aside, soul is spelled S-O-U-L. End of readers aside. Those who penetrate beneath the surface of Christianity and study deeply learn that while history ran its course, human soul quality altered. In other words, because of certain events that happened in ancient times, the human soul, the working of which may be likened to a subconscious mind within one's being, took to itself a quality quite unlike that which was originally intended. Buddhists' position relative to the material world may be expressed differently. A Buddhist would say, quote, I have been taken out of a divine spiritual realm and placed upon this earth. When I look around me, I find nothing but illusion. All is Maya. Close quote. The Christian, on the other hand, would say, quote, when I came down into this material life, had I but conformed to the order and intent of that divine plan in which I had my part, I could even now look beyond this perceptual pretense, behind all this deception, this Maya, and I would at all times have the power to realize and discern that which is genuine and true. Because my deeds were not in harmony with those things that had been ordained when I descended upon this earth, I have, through my own act, caused this world to become an illusion. Close quote. To answer the question, quote, why is the world one of Maya? The Buddha answers thus, it is the world itself that is Maya. Close quote. But the Christian says, quote, it is I who am at fault, I alone. My limited capacity for discernment and my whole soul state have placed me in such a position that I can no more apprehend that which was in the beginning. And my actions and conduct have ceased to be of such a nature that results follow smoothly, ever attended with beneficial and fruitful progress. I myself have enwrapped this material life in a veil of Maya. Close quote. The Buddhist's standpoint is that the world is a great illusion and must be overcome. The Christian says, quote, I have been placed upon this earth and must here find the purpose and object of my being. Close quote. When Christians once understand that through spiritual science knowledge may be acquired concerning recurrent earth lives, they then realize that they may use this wisdom for the achievement of the true aim of existence. They become convinced that the reason why we now look upon a world of sorrow and deception is that we have wandered from our allotted path. They consider that this change to Maya is the direct result of human deeds and the manner in which they regard the world. Christians, therefore, are of the opinion that in order to attain eternal bliss, we must not seek to withdraw ourselves from this earthly state, but instead master the condition that we alone have brought about, and through which the aspect of all material things has been transformed into one of illusion, such that we no longer apprehend them in their truth and reality. We must overcome this deception. Then may we follow the course of our first duly appointed destiny, for latent within each one of us abides a higher personality. If this more noble, hidden self were not hindered, and could but look around upon the world, it would apprehend it in truth. Human beings would then no longer continue an existence hampered by sickness and death, but lead an everlasting life in all the freshness of youth. Such, then, is the true inner self that we have veiled, because in the past we have been associated with a certain event in the world's development, the effects of which have continued, while the primary impulses still work within us, thus proving that we do not exist isolated and alone. We must not believe that we have been led to our present condition through a thirst for existence common to the individual human. Rather, must we realize that each one of us is a definite unit in the sum total of humanity, and as such must take a share and suffer from the results of any original transgression committed by humankind. In this way, Christians feel they are historically united with the whole human race. While they look into the future, they say, quote, through travail and toil, I must regain touch with the greater self, that because of human beings' fall, now lies enshrouded within my being. It is not nirvana that I must seek, but my more noble ego. Alone must I find the way back to my true nature. And then will the outer world no longer be an illusion, a vision of unreality, but a world wherein I shall overcome my own power and effort. But a world wherein I shall overcome of my own power and effort all sorrow, sickness, and death. Close quote. While Buddhists would seek freedom from earthly conditions and from rebirth through the struggle with the thirst for existence, Christians seek liberation from their lower personality and look forward to the awakening of a higher self, that more exalted ego, which they alone have veiled, so that through awakening they may at last apprehend this perceptual world in the light of divine truth. When we compare those significant words of St. Paul, quote, yet not I, but Christ liveth in me, close quote, Galatians 2:20, with the wisdom revealed by the Buddha, the contrast is as that between light and darkness. In St. Paul's words we find expressed that positive knowledge, that definite consciousness, which is always active deep within us, and by virtue of which we take our place as human personalities in the world. According to Buddhists, humankind has lapsed from spiritual heights because this material world has pressed them down and implanted in them a thirst for existence. This desire they must overcome. They must away. Christians, on the other hand, say no. The world is not to blame because of our present state. The fault lies with us alone. We Christians dwell upon this earth equipped with our accustomed consciousness. But beneath all awareness and understanding, there is a something active in each individual personality that in olden times found expression in the form of clairvoyant, visioned consciousness, no more extant. Even while we possessed this faculty, we transgressed. If we would indeed reach the ultimate goal of our existence, then must we first atone for this human error. No human being who is advanced in years may say, quote, in my early life I sinned. It is unjust that I should now be called upon to make atonement for youthful faults, committed at a time when I had not yet attained to that fuller knowledge which is now mine. Close quote. It would be equally wrong to assert that it is unfair to be expected to use our present conscious power to such end that we may compensate for misdeeds enacted while in possession of a different conscious faculty, which faculty no longer exists, for it has been replaced by an intellectual cognition. The only way in which humans may truly atone, when indeed the will is there, is for them to raise themselves upward from their present conscious state and existing ego to a higher plane of personality, a more exalted capital I. Those words of St. Paul, quote, yet not I, but Christ liveth in me, close quote, could then be characterized as, quote, yet not I, but a higher consciousness liveth in me. Close quote. The Christian conception can be expressed in these words. Quote, I have fallen from a higher spiritual state, and have entered upon a different condition from that which was previously ordained. But I must rise again. And this I must do not through the quality of ego that is mine, but by virtue of a power that can enter into my very being, uplifting me far above the I that I now possess. Such a change can alone come to pass when the Christ influence is once more active within, leading me onward until the world has lost all power of illusion, and I can apprehend it in its true reality. Ever upward must I strive, until those baneful forces that have brought sickness and death upon the earth may be vanquished. Conquered by the higher spiritual power, Christ has brought to life within my being. Close quote. The innermost essence of Buddhism is best understood by comparing the Buddhist creed with that of Christianity. We at once realize why it was that Lessing should have made use of the phrase, quote, is not all eternity mine, close quote, in his book entitled The Education of Humankind. These words imply that if we employ the experiences gained during our repeated reincarnations in such a way as to allow the Christ force to abide more and more within us, we shall at last reach the eternal spheres, which realms we cannot as yet hope to attain, because we have, of our own act, enveloped the inner being as with a veil. The idea of reincarnation will present a wholly different aspect when illumined by the glory of Christianity. But it is not merely the actual belief in rebirth that matters for the present. For with the advance of Christian culture, humanity will gradually be driven to the acceptance of this concept as truth brought forward by spiritual science. It is important that we should realize that whereas the deepest sentiments and convictions of the Buddhist faith cause Buddhists to blame the world for everything that is Maya, Christians, on the other hand, look upon themselves and humankind in general as responsible for all earthly deception and illusion. They store within their inmost being those qualities prerequisite and necessary to rise to the state we term redemption. In the Christian sense, however, this does not imply only deliverance, but actual resurrection. For when human beings have attained to this state, the ego is raised to the level of that more exalted I from which we have fallen. When Buddhists look upon the world, they find themselves concerned with original sin, but feel that they have been placed upon this earth merely for a time. They therefore desire freedom. Christians likewise realize their connection with original sin, but seek amendment and to atone for this first transgression. Such is the historical line of thought. For while Christians feel that their present existence is associated with an incident that took place in olden times among the ancients, they also connect their lives with an event that will surely come to pass when they are so advanced that their whole being will shine forth, filled with that radiance we designate as the essence of the Christ being. Thus it is that during the world's development we find nothing in Christianity corresponding to successive Buddha epochs, coming one after another, as one might say, unhistorically, each Buddha proclaiming a like doctrine. Christianity brings forward but one single glorious event during the whole of human earthly progress. In the same way as the Buddhist pictures the Buddha seated isolated and alone under the Bodhi tree, at the moment when he was exalted and the great illumination came to him, so does the Christian visualize Jesus of Nazareth at that time when there descended upon him the all-inspiring spirit of the cosmos. The baptism of Christ by John, as described in the Bible, is as vivid and clear a picture as the Buddhist's conception of the illumination of the Buddha. Thus we have in the first case the Buddha seated under the Bodhi tree, and concerned only with his own soul. In the second we have Jesus of Nazareth standing in the Jordan, while there descended upon him that cosmic essence, that spirit symbolically represented as a dove, which entered into his innermost being. To those who profess Buddhism, there is something about the Buddha and his works that is as a voice saying, quote, "Thou shalt still this thirst for earthly existence, tear it out by the roots, and follow the Buddha on to those realms that no earthly words can describe." Close quote. Christians have a similar feeling with regard to the life and example of Christ, for there seems to come forth an influence that makes it possible for them to atone for that primeval deed committed by ancient humanity. They know that when in their souls the divine cosmic influence, born of the great spiritual world that lies behind this perceptual earth, becomes as great a living force as in the Christ himself, then will they carry into future reincarnations the increasing realization of the truth of St. Paul's words, quote, "Yet not I, but Christ liveth in me." Close quote. They will then be raised more and more ever upward to that divine state from which they have fallen. When such a faith is ours, we cannot help but be deeply moved when we hear the story of how the Buddha, as he addressed his intimate disciples, spoke to them as follows. Quote, "When I look back upon my former lives as I might look into an open book, where I can read page after page and review each life in turn that has passed, I find in every one of these earthly existences that I have built for myself a material body in which my spirit has dwelt as in a temple. But I now know that this same body in which I have become Buddha will in truth be the last." Close quote. Speaking of that nirvana into which he would so soon enter, the Buddha said, quote, "I already feel that the beams are cracking and the supports giving way, that this physical body that has been raised up for the last time will soon be wholly and finally destroyed." Close quote. Let us compare these words with the words of Christ as recorded in the Gospel of John 2:19. When Jesus, intimating that he lived in a body that was external and apart, said, quote, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." Close quote. Here we have an exactly opposite point of view, which might be interpreted thus, quote, "I will perform a deed that will enliven and make fruitful all that in this world is of God and has come down to human beings from primeval times and entered into their being." Close quote. These words imply that Christians, during recurrent earth lives, must exercise every faculty in order to give truth to the affirmation, quote, "Yet not I, but Christ liveth in me." Close quote. We must, however, clearly understand that Christ's reference to the rebuilding of the temple has an eternal significance and means that the Christ power enters into and is absorbed by all who truly realize that they themselves must play a constructive part in the collective evolution of humanity. It is entirely wrong to speak of the event that gave rise to what we term the Christ impulse as though we anticipated its recurrence in some form during the further development of humankind. When Buddhists ponder in accordance with the true concepts of their creed, they picture the advent of several Buddhas, appearing one after another throughout recurring Buddha epochs, all of which, during the course of their earth lives, had a similar character and significance. Christians look back to a single past event described as the fall of human beings through sin, while they point to its converse in the mystery of Golgotha. They who believe that the Christ event will at some later period be repeated merely show that they have not grasped the true essence of the historical evolution of humankind. History tells us that this idea has been frequently put forward in the past, and it is likely that it will again reappear in the future. The course of true history must always be dependent upon a single basic event. Just as the arm of a balance must have one point of equilibrium, and the beam from which the scales hang have just one point of support, So in the case of a true record of the evolution of humankind, there must be a single circumstance to which its historical development, taken either backward or forward, always points. It is as absurd to speak of a repetition of the Christ event as it would be to assert that the beam of a balance could be supported and swing upon two points. That Eastern wisdom should hold to the belief that a number of similar spiritual personalities succeed each other at intervals, as it does in the case of the Buddhas, is characteristic of the difference existing between the Eastern cosmic conception and that which has sprung up among the Western countries as the result of so much painstaking observation and thought concerning the course of evolution. The Western concept first began to take definite form at the time of the manifestation of the Christ impulse, which we must regard as a unique circumstance. If we oppose the oneness and singularity character of the Christ event, we argue against the possibility of the true historical evolution of humankind. And to argue against historical evolution betrays a misunderstanding of genuine history. In its deepest sense, we can term that consciousness possessed by individual human beings of indissoluble association with humanity as a whole as the Christian consciousness. Through it, we become aware of a definite purpose underlying the course of all human evolution, and realize that here indeed can be no mere repetition. Such consciousness is an attribute of Christianity, from which it cannot be separated. The real progress that humankind has made during its period of development is shown in the advance from the ancient Eastern cosmic conception to the philosophic concept of modern times, from the unhistoric to the historic, from a belief that the wheels of human chance roll on through a succession of similar events to a conviction that underlying the whole of human evolution is a definite purpose, a design of profound significance. We realize that it is Christianity that first revealed the true meaning of the doctrine of reincarnation. We can now state that the reason why humans must experience recurrent earth lives is so that they may be again and again instilled with the true import of material existence. With this object, they are confronted with a different aspect of being during each incarnation. There is, throughout humanity, an upward tendency that is not confined merely to the isolated individual, but extends to the entire human race, with which we feel ourselves so intimately connected. The Christ impulse, the center of all, causes us to realize that humans can become conscious of the glory of this divine relationship. Then no more will they acknowledge only the creed of Buddha, who cries out to him, "Free thyself!" They will become aware of their union with the Christ, whose deed has reclaimed them from the consequences of that decadence, symbolically represented as the fall of the human being through sin. We cannot describe Buddhism better than by showing that it is the afterglow of a cosmic conception, the sun of which has nearly set. But with the advent of Gautama, it shone forth with one last brilliant, powerful ray. We revere the Buddha nonetheless. We honor him as a great spirit, as one whose voice called into the past and brought back into this earthly life once again that mood which brings with it so clear a consciousness of the human connection with ancient primordial wisdom. On the other hand, we know that the Christ impulse points resolutely toward the future, penetrating more and more deeply into the very soul of the human being, so that humanity may realize that it is not release and freedom that it should seek, but resurrection, that glorious transfiguration of our earthly being. It is in such a metamorphosis that we find the inner meaning of our material life. It is futile to search among dogmas, concepts, and ideas for the active principle of existence, For the vital element of life lies in our impulses, emotions, and feelings. It is through these moods that we may apprehend the true significance of human evolution and development. There may be some who feel themselves more drawn toward Buddhism than toward Christianity. And we must admit that even in our time, there is something about Buddhism that inspires a certain sympathy in many minds, and which is, to a certain extent, in the nature of a Buddha mood or disposition. Such a feeling, however, did not exist with Goethe, who sought to free himself from the pains he endured as a result of the narrow-mindedness he found everywhere about him at the time of his first sojourn in Weimar. His endeavor in this respect was wholly due to his love of life and his conviction that interwoven throughout all external being is the same spiritual essence. That is the true origin of the divine element in human beings. Goethe strove to achieve this liberation from distress through observation of the outer world, going from plant to plant, from mineral to mineral, and from one work of art to another, always seeking that underlying spirit from which the human soul emanates. At the same time, he sought to unify himself with the divine essence that manifests throughout all external things. In conversation with Schopenhauer, regarding the influence of Schopenhauer's thoughts and ideas upon his pupil, Goethe once said, quote, When your carefully considered and worthy conceptions come into contact with a wholly different trend of thought, they will be found at variance with one another. Close quote. Schopenhauer had established a maxim expressed in his often repeated words as follows, quote, life is precarious, and it is through deep meditation that I seek to alleviate its burdens. Close quote. What he really sought was the illumination that would reveal and make clear the true origin and intent of existence. It was therefore only natural that Buddhist concepts should enter his mind and mingle with his ideas, causing him to ponder upon this old creed. During the progress of the 19th century, the different branches of human culture have yielded such great and far-reaching results that the mind of humans seems incapable of adjusting in harmony to the flood of new ideas that continually pour in upon it as a consequence of effort expended in scientific research. The mind feels more and more helpless before the enormous mass of facts that is the unceasing product of such investigations. We have found this vast world of accepted truths to be wonderfully in accord with the concepts of spiritual science, but it is noteworthy that although human beings' reasoning powers increased greatly during the last century, nevertheless they soon failed to keep pace with the immense inflow of scientific data. Thus it was that just toward the close of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, human beings realized that they could not hope to understand and master all this new knowledge by means of the human intellect alone. Everything about us is connected with and extends into the cosmos and the world of spirit. And this outer realm is still beyond the limits of human beings' normal faculties of comprehension. They must therefore seek another way, some as yet untrodden path. Thus it is that humankind has sought a cosmic philosophy, not wholly at variance with all those facts coming from the outer world and that make inward appeal to the soul. Spiritual science is based upon the most profound conceptions and experiences of divine wisdom, and is ever ready to deal with all fresh truths and data brought forward by external science, to assimilate them, and throw new light upon their significance, showing at the same time that in all that exists in external life is embodied the divine essence, the spirit. There are some people, however, who find the concepts of spiritual science inconvenient and unsuitable. They turn away from the world of reality, which demands so much thought and effort for its unfoldment, and according to their own knowledge and personal ideas, seek a higher plane merely through the development of their individual souls. Thus we have what may be termed an, quote, unconscious Buddhism, close quote, which has long existed and has been active in the philosophies of the 19th and 20th centuries. When so-called unconscious Buddhists come into contact with true Buddhism, then, because of indolence and inertia, they feel themselves more at home with this Eastern creed than with European spiritual science, which comes to grips with widespread facts, because it knows that throughout the entire range of reality, the Divine Spirit is ever manifest. There is no doubt that the present sympathy and interest evinced with regard to Buddhism is due in part to feebleness of will and want of faith, born of undeveloped spiritual knowledge. The whole essence of the Christian cosmic conception, which seems to have been in Goethe's mind, demands that human beings shall not give way to their own weak spiritual understanding and talk of the limitations of human knowledge, but feel that there is within them something that will carry them above all illusion and bring them to truth and reality, freeing them forever from terrestrial existence. A cosmic conception of this nature may call for much patient resignation, but such is of quite a different order from that which shrinks before the contemplation of the limits of human understanding. Resignation in the Kantian sense implies that humankind is altogether incapable of penetrating the deep secrets of the cosmos, and its chief feature lies in the special acknowledgment of the feebleness of human comprehension. That of Goethe is of a different character, and is expressed in these words, quote, "You have not yet come so far that you can apprehend the universe in all its glorious reality, but you are capable of developing yourself." Close quote. Resignation of this kind leads on to that stage of growth and progress when human beings will truly be in a position to call forth the Christ nature from within their being. They yield because they realize that the highest point of their mundane development has not yet been attained. Such an attitude is noble and fully in accord with human understanding. It implies that we pass from life to life with a consciousness of being, looking forward into the future in the knowledge that with regard to recurrent earthly existence, all eternity is ours. Goethe, led on by his truly Christian impulse, regarded the world after the manner of his character Faust. When we cease to look about us in a trivial mood, and when we truly realize that all material works must perish, and death at last overtake the body, then with Goethe we can say, quote, "If we take heed and ponder our earthly activities, there will come knowledge born of experience, teaching us that while all those things wrought and accomplished in this world must pass away, that which we have built up within ourselves through toil and striving, during our contact with the school of earthly life, shall not perish, for that is indeed everlasting." Close quote. When we consider human evolution, we find ourselves confronted with two modern currents of thought, each leading to a different cosmic conception. One, due to Schopenhauer, pictures the world with all its misery and sufferings as of such a nature that we can realize and appreciate the human being's true position only when we gaze upon the works of the great artists. In these masterpieces, we often find portrayed the form and figure of a being who, through asceticism, has attained to something approaching liberation from earthly existence, and hovers, as it were, above this lower terrestrial life. Fundamentally, Schopenhauer was of the opinion that in the case of a human being thus freed, retrospection concerning material conditions no longer exists, and that herein lies the preeminent characteristic of such liberation. Thus those who have thus won their way to freedom can truly say, quote, "I am still clothed in my bodily garment, but it has now lost all significance. There is nothing left about me that might in time to come recall my earthly life. I strive upward in anticipation of that state with which I shall gain contact when I have at last wholly overcome the world and all that pertains to it." Close quote. Of such a nature was the sentiment of Schopenhauer after he had become imbued with those ideas and convictions that Buddhist teaching has spread abroad in the world. So with Faust we think not of how our mundane works may endure, but look forward to the fruits that they will bring forth in the course of the soul's eternal life. Thus are we carried far out and beyond the narrow confines of the Buddhist creed into a world of thought that finds brief expression in those impressive words of Goethe, quote, "Eons cannot erase the traces of my days on earth," close quote. The end of Lecture 3.